You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. So the amendment on the government's coronavirus emergency powers that would put a parliamentary lock on those powers has been tabled by Sir Graham Brady. He told Andrew Neil, The Spectator's chairman, on Spectator TV last night this.
The amendment has got, I think, something just over 45 names on it. Crucially, we have more than 40 Conservative MPs signing it, but also support from the other side of the House as well. We have Labour MPs and Unionists among the signatories. We've got the numbers just amongst the people who signed the amendment. There are actually an awful lot more who've indicated they would support the amendment if it comes to a division.
The full list of names are now out of those over 40 MPs who are supporting the amendment. James, what does that list of names say to you?
Well, I mean, the most striking thing about this list of names is that this isn't just the libertarian wing of the Tory party grumbling. It's been signed by Damien Green, Theresa May's former deputy prime minister, Bob Neil, the chair of the Justice Select Committee, a figure on the kind of left of the party, Harriet Baldwin, as well as kind of Ian Duncan Smith, Steve Baker, and Philip Davies. And I think what this shows you is that this view on the role of Parliament in scrutinising these restrictions on voting on them, that isn't confined to one small wing of the Tory party. Now, look, with more than 40 Tory MPs already having signed the amendment, and more like Tom Tugendhat and Bernard Jenkin having come out since saying that they would back it, it's quite clear that if this amendment gets called, which it isn't certain that it is, the government would lose the vote if the opposition parties backed it. So Number 10 have already tried to offer some concessions preemptively. You know, Boris Johnson spoke in one of his recent appearances in the Commons about how there would be more statements, more debates, more chances for MPs to question the government's scientific advisers, Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance. I'm sure they're looking forward to that. But I think most of these people who signed this amendment, what they want, talking to them, is votes. And I mean, that is something that the government is still very reluctant to concede.
Katie, how damaging, politically speaking, would it be for the government to lose this vote in the Commons next week if the amendment is called?
I think it's damaging because it suggests that a large portion of the Conservative Party doesn't have faith in Number 10 to be making decisions of their own accord. Now, it's not damaging in the sense that it's quite clear that MPs want to be able to apply scrutiny to decisions. You know, I don't think that it would be normal for all MPs to just want Number 10 to make every decision and never get in touch with them. But I think it does show, given the circumstances, that clearly both sides have different views on how things should be progressing at this point. And I think, as James touched on, just the fact that this is so far spread across the party with lots of different factions and wings, being willing to sign the Brady Amendment, I think touches on the sense that people do feel quite cut off from the general operation. They don't feel as though their views are being put in, and they have questions about the current coronavirus strategy. And in a way, the beauty of the Brady Amendment is, even though Graham Brady himself has spoken about, you know, lessons you can learn from Sweden, you can look at this amendment and you can take the view we should be having a circuit break. You can still support that amendment. It's about the sense that being consulted rather than just being someone who is more of a lockdown sceptic. So while I think it is something that is particularly supported by lockdown sceptics, it is not exclusive to that. And you can also see a little bit of Labour support towards it too, which I think is interesting. Obviously, it comes down to whether or not this is picked or not. But I think even if for some reason Lindsay Hoyle decides this amendment cannot be added, it doesn't have the force. And we also know conversations are going behind the scenes, so it could be a compromise arise before then. It does just show, as James has in his cover piece, that sooner or later there is going to be a clash, which is going to, you know, have consequences between Boris Johnson's government and his party, because they are at odds. And therefore, you can delay that. Perhaps they'll get lucky. Perhaps they'll do a small concession. Perhaps there won't be a vote next week because it won't be picked. But the feelings aren't going to go away. If anything, they're probably going to become more heightened. So I think it hints at that.
I mean, it's interesting. Graham Brady was saying on Spectator TV last night, pointing out that John Cryer, who's the chair of the Parliamentary Labour Party, has also signed this amendment. And I think there is a kind of general sense on backbenches across the House that, you know, that that Parliament is not having any say in this, and it is beginning to make Parliament look slightly ridiculous. So, I mean, we are not in the same situation I think we were in March, when there was kind of real fear about whether Parliament could continue meeting in all this situation. You know, I mean, not only is Parliament sitting right now, but there is also now a system of remote voting in place. I thought one of the other interesting points that Graham Brady made last night, which he said he kind of used to persuade some people to sign the amendment, was that the government actually has other tools at its disposal. Under the Civil Contingencies Act, it can take steps overnight, for example, to do things. So, for example, overnight it could lock down London. It would just simply have to come to Parliament within a short period of time and get Parliament to retrospectively approve its actions. And I think that is one of the reasons why support for this amendment isn't going to go away. The government's best argument would be, look, this is a fast-moving situation and we need to be able to take rapid action. But the government is struggling. The government will struggle to make that argument given the other powers it has available. And then I think the other problem for the government is the government hasn't helped its own case in two particular ways that have irked MPs. The first is that the Rule of Six was announced in a televised press conference. Matt Hancock had appeared in the House of Commons the day before but hadn't bothered to say it. The Prime Minister didn't come from the televised press conference straight to the Commons to have a debate. And then the second thing is when the Rule of Six came into legal force on Monday, the laws certainly weren't published until after I'd gone to bed on Sunday night, which was kind of, what, 10:30, 11 or something like that. And I think it is quite hard to argue that if the law is going to change at midnight, it's all right for the text of what the law of the land is going to be to not be available to people an hour beforehand. You know, I mean, I'm happy to say that I didn't wake up and inadvertently break the law. But, you know, I mean, normally the lawyers would say that ignorance of a law is no excuse. But, you know, but genuinely in that circumstance, you know, if someone had been caught on the wrong side of the law at 10:10, I mean, they would have had a legitimate argument but they hadn't had sufficient time to acquaint themselves with what the new law was.
Meanwhile, Katie, Scottish students are having probably, with no competition, the worst start to university year anyone could possibly think of. Can you tell us what's going on for those students?
Yes, I think it's a bad time to be a student generally. It's also a particularly bad time to be a student in Scotland. But the good news is, well, perhaps for those feeling particularly hard done by in Scotland, is what happens in Scotland tends to eventually come to England with coronavirus.
Right, 2 weeks later.
Give it time, and maybe it'll just be a bad time to be a student anywhere in the UK. But ultimately what's happened is we know there was an outbreak at a few campuses, particularly in Glasgow. What you've had is there's guidance that students should not go to pub or restaurants. Now, this has been clarified, and it is now apparently over the weekend, the First Minister has said, so just for this weekend. And I think it comes as, particularly in Glasgow, in quite a few of the halls of residence, you've had, I think, a couple of hundred people now test positive for coronavirus. They're all being asked to isolate within their accommodation. And this is a move. But I think what's interesting about it is, obviously, it's one thing when you're living in student halls that the people in charge can make decisions in terms of how many people you can have in a room, i.e. no more than just yourself, apparently. And, you know, how if you break these rules, there'll be consequences. But this is now actually saying, even if you leave the university campus and you leave your halls and you don't have coronavirus, we're telling you you can't go to a pub, which has nothing to do with the university. So I think it does sound quite extreme, and it's already had quite a bit of a backlash from politicians, actually, as well as people just pointing out unfairness. But I think there's a bigger problem, which is ultimately a problem that you keep hearing from students, and we've heard it from a few interns we've had over the summer, is that lots of these people have, the universities have ultimately suggested, and I won't go into specifics because I'll start to go wrong, but there's a general sense that universities have suggested to these students that they did need to be there, so they should sign expensive contracts on accommodation because there would be some type of, you know, in-person learning. And then obviously they sign all these things, they're told they should go up, and they find that actually everything is remote. They could have just stayed in their home, could have stayed with their parents. And then they're told that they shouldn't actually, and this is a UK government thing, they may not actually be allowed to go and see their parents at Christmas because it could be too dangerous to have everyone moving. And I think there's this general narrative at the moment, which we've seen a lot, which is like young people are the problem and young people are mixing too much and that's why the rate of infection's gone up. But I do think we have to give these students a bit of a break. I mean, if genuinely the government, both the Scottish government and I think Westminster to a degree, thinks that once these students get to university, they shouldn't go to any classes, tutorials or lectures. They also shouldn't really leave the accommodation, at least in parts of the country, say that they shouldn't even contribute money to nearby establishments. why have they been told they should go back in the first place? And also, should there be more foresight in one thing that's come up? Is it that halls of accommodation are too densely populated? Well, that could be thought of. I think it's getting quite easy to try and blame these people for being like irresponsibly behaved when actually perhaps you've had irresponsible planning.
I couldn't agree with that more. I think the other point, I mean, obviously, if this was going to be the rules, it would have been much better to say to students, stay at home with your family home and learn on Zoom. You know, obviously, less good than in person, but you know. But I also think the Scottish government's request that students do not go to pubs and restaurants this weekend also leads on to an interesting question. There's great resistance to the idea of segmenting the population. But this is just what the Scottish government have done, but completely the wrong way around. So we're telling the people who would probably, to be fair, most like to go out, but they can't go out and must stay in, to protect old people who are probably less keen to go to the pubs, restaurants, nightclubs, you know, and the like. And I think this is the problem. I think we need a much more honest conversation about segmenting the population, which, you know, Boris Johnson kind of dismissed on the grounds that it would be very unfair to lock people up while other people are out living their lives on Tuesday night. But that is just what is happening to students in Scotland. They are being knocked up. I always think there's another point here, which is I hope that there is some compensatory measures, you know, not just, I think, in financial terms, for the fact they are, you know, I find it hard to see how the £9,000 fees, you know, I know that doesn't apply in Scotland, but to English universities for all Zoom tuition applies. I mean, this is not a flippant point. If you are going to lock students on campus, right, why not just say that's a bubble? If you stay in the bubble, you can have a normal university experience within your bubble. You know, there will be regular supplies. You know, you can have parties, there'll be alcohol later on, all these things. But the deal is, like the cricket teams during the test match series, you don't leave your bubble. You know, things like that, you know, if you're talking about planning, those are the things that should be being done rather than this instruction that students mustn't go to a pub or a restaurant this weekend.
And Katie, speaking of planning, supermarket bosses are starting to have to think about their supply chains once again, as Tesco has put a limit on how much you can buy from their shops and shelves are running empty again. Are you bulk buying yet, Katie?
I'm not bulk buying.
You don't have space in your flat, probably, for two
I have meetings. A very small fridge, and just when 2020 had started, I kind of made a plan it would only have liquids in it. Not just alcohol, also cans. I was like, that's all my fridge is going to be good for. And then everything else I'll just work around. And then that didn't work out very well for me because then obviously we had a global pandemic. Yes. And then it turned out, because my kitchen is absolutely tiny and yeah, I've only got one freezer shelf. Don't know how interesting this is to podcast listeners, so apologies.
This is top quality content you do not get anywhere else.
I didn't really have much room to stash anything. But also by the time I got around to do it, I remember going to the big Sainsbury's in my flat, and it was just like Armageddon, people were running, there was like one toilet roll, but I only managed to get a few tins, but at the same time I didn't have much space for more. But you know, so I haven't stockpiled yet. There's obviously limits on things, but I do think, and obviously this does depend a little bit of Brexit, and perhaps James will want to update us on his Times column shortly, but I think we saw last time around how actually we didn't run out of items, so I hope people can actually be a little bit less panic buying this time. And obviously with those delivery slots and things, particularly in the winter, it's going to be much worse for those, you know, the elderly people who will find it even harder to get out and do their shops. So I'm hoping we can all just be a bit calm. I might put a little bit of food in my fridge, but not a huge amount.
James, are you optimistic people will be more reasonable this time round? I know one person in this office who's gone bulk buying. It's not Katie Balls. I'm
always personally, I'm almost slightly sceptical of bulk buying. I think not to turn this into a discussion of our domestic freezer arrangements.
I don't know why we're doing a Saturday podcast on a different topic.
Generally, people who can bulk buy are people who have garages and large freezers. And sadly, neither Katie nor I are at that state in life. But I think this is a sign that people are beginning to worry about this kind of. I still personally think one of the most remarkable things about the last lockdown was how the supermarket delivery chains held up. What's remarkable is that even with some panic buying and the like, you still could basically get almost everything you wanted in most places in the UK.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And to watch that full interview between Andrew and Sir Graham Brady, go on to spectator.co.uk/TV. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.
You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.